I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of August 13th, 2010. It's been called one of the most successful government programs ever, Social Security, and it is celebrating a birthday. We'll mark the occasion by asking what happens when a social safety net is your only net. And as cleanup continues along the Gulf Coast, have any of us changed our habits to use less oil?
I've not done a thing. I do the right thing only because it's easy. And I think that's the solution, is to make it much easier for people to do the right thing.
And as summer draws to a close, just how far are you willing to go to save money on a vacation?
I think it's mainly only in Athens, and it occurred to me that perhaps it might be a little cheaper now with the bankruptcy fears.
Traveling to a hotspot to save a buck. But first, ...75 candles on the cake. Happy birthday to Social Security. On August 14th, 1935, FDR signed into law the Social Security Act, also known as Old Age Survivors and Disability Insurance. The first person to receive a check was a Cleveland retiree named Ernest Ackman. His lump sum payment? 17 cents. Well, today more than 58 million people receive some sort of benefit from the program. For many of them, it is their only income. Peter O'Dowd of station KJZZ in Phoenix has a glimpse into their lives.
Last year, the Social Security Administration paid out nearly $700 billion to elderly and disabled Americans. Richard Kempner, he's one of them.
Good morning. Welcome to the Danner Olive Grant Senior Center for lunch. My name is Rick, and I hope you're all doing well.
Kempner is preparing the lunchtime announcements at this senior center in Sun City, Arizona's most famous retirement community.
Now, you know we need it quiet so you can hear me. Please.
Kempner is 62, and he wants you to hear what it's like to survive on nothing but a pair of bad knees and a Social Security check. Every month, the U.S. government sends Kempner $1,300.
It's not enough. I mean, I'm behind the eight ball each and every month. Being disabled, I'm unable to really work. I have certain fixed bills that I have to pay, and it's just been a real struggle.
Every month, Kempner pays homeowner's fees, mortgage payments, utilities. He takes a $300 advance from Social Security before his check is even cut. Sometimes he has to ask the Olive Branch Senior Center for help paying his mortgage. Kempner used to be an accountant, yet he never bothered to save. I traveled across town to the Devonshire Senior Center to see if the situation of people like Kempner is unusual. It isn't.
I'm Annie Monrad, and this is my favorite pastime, being here at Devonshire shooting pool.
Monrad is 73 years old. She has a bachelor's degree and a master's in linguistics, but she tended bar for most of her working life.
And I live on Social Security. I get $1,040 a month. So I don't turn on my air conditioner. I'm dying of heat.
Monrad told me she thought she'd live forever. She saved a little, but she admits she was completely unprepared for retirement. At the end of each month, she has nothing left.
My life is very, very different. You buy inexpensive food. You don't go anyplace. So all I can do is be as cautious as I can about the money I spend and hope that it's enough.
I met a few others at the Devonshire Senior Center, and the stories were similar. AARP estimates 14% of the elderly rely solely on Social Security. The manager of the Olive Branch Senior Center in Sun City says half of her members have no other source of income. I met one of the residents, Susie Roberts, in the dining room at the Olive Branch. The room was bright and the music cheerful, but that masked the fragile existence of so many people here.
I never resented paying into Social Security because I knew it was going to be a buffer when I got older. I didn't realize I was going to end up relying on it.
But just like the others, Susie Roberts now depends on the government. Every month, Uncle Sam sends the former office manager $1,000. Almost half of that pays for medication to keep her alive. Roberts splurges on a perm twice a year. She shops at thrift stores for used clothes.
What you see is what you get. If you're looking for a rich old lady, you ain't gonna get one.
This 74-year-old woman has a sweet smile, but she knows this isn't funny. Without Social Security, she says she'd be homeless.
I would be stuck in some corner someplace. My children can't afford to take care of me. They have families. The Olive Branch is my mainstay. I'm sorry, I get emotional.
Robert's advice? Save. And save now. Because she believes the next generation will face similar problems. The government predicts Social Security will falter by 2037. By then, tax revenues will only pay for 75% of scheduled benefits.
God bless America, land that I love.
Roberts composes herself before moving to the dining room where Richard Kepner is leading the group in song. When he's done, 100 people will eat a free plate of breaded cod and mashed potatoes. In Phoenix, I'm Peter O'Dowd for Marketplace Money.
If that last story isn't enough to get you saving more for retirement on your own, here's more food for thought. What if you had to wait longer to collect those Social Security benefits? House Minority Leader John Boehner recently touched his finger to the third rail of American politics and proposed raising the retirement age to 70. He's not the first to make the suggestion, but we wanted to explore what that might mean for future retirees. Dr. Christian Weller is an expert on Social Security at the Center for American Progress. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let's just say up front that we're really not going to get into the party politics of this issue at this point, but I wanted you to explore with us some of the more practical implications of raising the Social Security retirement age. First and foremost, it really affects all those calculations you do for how much you need to save on your own, right?
Well, if you're raised a retirement age, it's a question not just how much more money you need to save, but also the calculation is complicated by the fact that your health will play a big role. Mm. About 35 to 45% of people who retire early do so because of bad health. For those people, raising a retirement age is just a benefit cut that is not buffered by other sources of income.
So what does this do to the calculation overall then? I mean, even something as basic as these calculators that you can go online and use and try to figure out, you know, how much money you need to save for retirement. 5 years is a big difference for Social Security, isn't it?
Well, every year that you raise the retirement age either means people save more money up front, mm-hmm. or they work longer to ultimately receive the same amount of benefits. The problem with working longer, however, the unemployment rate for people 65 and older has been trending upwards, so there aren't that many jobs for those who want to work longer. The alternative is saving more, and we just simply, from a policy perspective, don't know how to get people to save more. Hmm. The saving rate in the United States has been very low for the past 20, 25 years. People ultimately realize that they have too little money, but it's often too late at that point.
If the retirement age were raised to 70, from what you know, would that then mean that if you waited until 74, 75, that you would get more benefits?
Presumably, the provisions wouldn't change. I think the general proposals are we go to 67 as scheduled under current law, and you just keep on going, raising the retirement age until you hit 70. But you also got to remember, for a lot of low-income families, workers, their life expectancy at age 65 is about 15 years. So when they reach 70, they're looking at less than 10 years of retirement. There isn't that much wiggle room to go beyond that.
What the minority leader suggested was that this new age cutoff of 70 would apply to anyone who at that point was at least 20 years from retiring. Does that give folks enough time to replan based on a new age?
In theory, 20 years should be enough time to replan, but we have that experience from the past that theory and practice do fall apart. Given our past experience, I'd be very doubtful that even with a 20-year lead time, people will start saving more for a delayed retirement.
I suppose really the safest way for all of us to avoid this being a problem is not to count on Social Security at all, if you can. Plan your retirement as though it's never going to be there.
Well, Social Security will be around, and people should plan on being there. Otherwise, they're going to save way too much money and consume way too little. When I say consume too little, basically people don't repair their homes. People don't go to the doctor when they need to. Those kinds of cuts are not particularly good for your living standards. So people should count on Social Security. Social Security will be around as a basic insurance for generations to come. Whether it will include a higher retirement age remains to be seen at this point.
Dr. Christian Weller is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. He's been joining us to talk about this proposal to raise the Social Security age to 70. Dr. Weller, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Forget raising the retirement age. The goal should be to lower the age of retirement. Yes, you heard me right. How about making it possible for everyone to retire at 55? What's more, we can afford it.
Economics editor Chris Farrell.
Too much of the discussion about the future of Social Security takes a doom and gloom tone. We're told again and again that to avoid financial ruin, we must make painful sacrifices. Yet the ambition should be to create a system that allows for greater freedom of choice for everyone in the last third of life, whether that means work or leisure or both. There are many ways to keep the system solvent without hiking the retirement age. If the economy is healthy and prosperous, fears of a financial collapse fade into the mists of time. Don't want to bank on economic growth? How about doubling the cap on annual wages subject to the payroll tax? Or lift it altogether? That policy change alone erases most of the projected future deficit of Social Security. That's fine as far as it goes, but let's make the system better. Nobel laureate Robert Fogel has proposed a mandatory savings plan that would exist alongside Social Security. The savings would be yours, and the money would give everyone the realistic option of retiring around 55. If the typical household put 15% of its annual income into retirement savings, they could be financially free to pursue passions when they're 50-something. Of course, the details of how we do it are almost less important than the bottom line. America is the world's wealthiest nation. We're also healthier and better educated than previous generations. The nation is rich enough to allow everyone to retire early, free to pursue their passions and their dreams. Retirement used to be something only the wealthy could afford. Everyone else needed an income, and most aging folks struggled to get work even as their faculties deteriorated. For decades, social activists called for a system to provide the elderly a steady income. The dream became reality starting with the Social Security Act of 1935. It became possible for people to think about their last stage of life as a time of leisure, recreation, and enjoyment. It's a remarkable social achievement that should be built on and expanded, not contracted.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and it's time to take your questions about what is going on with your finances. And here with me to do that this week is our friend Kathy Kristoff. Hi, Kathy.
Hey, Tess.
She writes about personal finance for CBS Money Watch. And I wanted to ask you where you stand on the retirement question. Are you planning to retire early at all or work late into your golden years? You know, we just had a big segment about possibly raising the retirement age for Social Security. And I don't know, your thoughts on that?
You know what? I guess I never really think about retirement. Mm. I think about working less. And I think that's kind of an increasing trend. You know, two generations, our grandparents' generation, when you retired at 65, you were pretty old. Our generation, you retire at 65, and it's like you've probably got another 30 years of active life going on. Yeah. And I just think I'd like to have a nicer, less stressful pace of work is really what I kind of imagine in retirement.
Have you thought about when you would retire?
Yeah, you know, I've saved a lot of money, but it's really for my midlife crisis. I figure it would just be a bummer to have a midlife crisis. It wasn't a lot of fun.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So what are you going to do for yourself when that happens? Well, it hasn't happened yet?
Well, no. I was waiting for my children to both go off to college.
Okay. So when is that coming then?
Well, soon. My son is about to go to college.
Oh, there you go. So midlife crisis versus retirement. I kind of like your idea. Maybe I'll have to think about that as well. All right. Well, shall we hear from one of our callers?
Yes, absolutely.
All right. Well, Aaron is with us from right down the street in Pasadena, California. Hi, Erin.
Hi.
How are you doing today?
I'm great. I'm in the classroom with my students, and they're all working on their group projects.
Oh, fantastic. what age are we talking here?
These are 10th graders at Poly High School.
What are they studying at this very moment?
Right now they're analyzing the persuasive power of ads.
Oh, that sounds fantastic. Give us a quick lesson on that, how to beware of the power of advertising and not succumb to it.
Well, you have to basically look at how the message is being delivered. Are they making stuff up? Are they using beautiful people in the hopes that you think you'll be beautiful too?
Well, I'm actually really glad to hear that you're teaching marketing, because that's certainly an element of personal finance, isn't it, Kathy?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Knowing how to know that a message is not valid is very, very handy when you're managing your own money.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so Erin, Kathy and I were just talking a little bit about retirement, and I'm guessing since you're in the L.A. school district that have you got one of those old-fashioned pensions?
Yes, I do. I'm one of the few lucky people left in the country who actually is hoping to have a pension when I retire. So.
And is that going to be enough for you?
My question is mostly about supplementing the retirement income with some sort of strategy. I know that the three that I've narrowed it down to are the 403B, an IRA of some kind, and then there's this guy who's like a friend of a friend who's recommending this insurance product. It's like universal life policy that I would borrow against, and it's tax-free. And
well, you've just scared Kathy by mentioning the insurance policy. Do we deal with that first?
What? Well, yeah. Okay.
Run away?
Let's just eliminate that one right now, because the pitch they give to you is that, oh, well, you don't have to pay tax on it because instead of pulling your money out, you can borrow it from us. Well, here's a clue. What's worse than paying taxes on money that you take out of your retirement account? Paying interest to borrow your own money to an insurance company.
Oh, jeez.
That's what you do.
All right. So it sounds like Kathy is not a fan of you going the insurance route. You mentioned a 403B. Is that offered through the school district?
Right. And it's through TIAA CREF. This is like supplemental so I can have adventures in retirement.
Right. And we'll just explain really quickly that the 403B is the nonprofit equivalent of a 401K.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
So I guess my question boils down to, do I want to have before tax contributions now and pay taxes later, or do I want to have after tax contributions now and pay no taxes later with like an IRA?
Like a Roth IRA is what you're talking about. Wouldn't a combination be best, Kathy?
A combination is a good idea. I think you're going to be rich when you retire because you're doing this now. And I think that the greatest thing to do is to put as much money aside wherever you can. You don't know what you're going to want to do later in life. What saving now does for you is give you more options. So a Roth IRA is great. The 403B, especially TIAA CREF, if you stay in the low-cost option, which I think is what you're talking about, right?
Right.
Perfect. So pick the one that is most comfortable and easiest for you. That sounds like it might be the 403B since you're already contributing to that.
So maybe later on when I'm getting more income, just do both?
Yes, absolutely. If you can do both, that's fabulous.
Great.
All right. So, Erin, I want you to do something for me, all right?
Okay.
Get everybody's attention.
Everybody, attention.
All right. And I would like everyone to repeat after me in a very loud voice the following. I vow.
I vow.
To save money.
To save money.
For retirement.
For retirement.
For retirement.
All right. Class dismissed.
Class dismissed. I can't dismiss them yet.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll leave that up to you then. Thanks, Erin.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. Well, shall we go to our next caller? It's Lisa, and she's in Vienna, Virginia. Hi, Lisa.
Hi.
How are you doing today?
I'm great. Thanks for taking my call.
Oh, you bet. Where do you listen to us there?
WAMU,
American
University in Washington, D.C.
Terrific. And what do you do there in Vienna?
I work for a human resources consulting firm.
So you know all about retirement plans then?
No, fortunately, I don't have to teach them anything about finance. That is not my strong suit.
Do you have kids?
I do. I have two kids. I have a daughter who's a rising sophomore in college and a son who is a rising junior in high school.
Ah, so I'm guessing that this might be about student loans.
Yeah, actually, we're all set in terms of financing their undergraduate education so far.
Wow.
We've invested in a Virginia prepaid education program.
Fantastic.
Oh, this is where you decide where they're going to go when they're kids, and you get a preset tuition rate, right?
Kind of, sort of, yeah. You can go to any Virginia public school. It is limiting in some sense, because if you decide to go to a private school within Virginia mm-hmm. or outside of the state, you don't get the full value of what you've put in.
Right. But then let me ask you this. What's that conversation like with your kids? You know, you don't want to tell them what to do, but there's certainly a benefit to taking one direction or another.
You mean to staying in state?
Yeah.
Well, it wasn't an issue with my daughter. We kind of knew that she would be going on to graduate school, and now she's talking about possibly medical school, which
is
kind of the nature of my question.
Uh-huh. Wow. Yeah, and I personally don't have any problem with telling your kids what to do.
I think you've mentioned that before, Kathy, actually.
Well, hello. If you want to pay for it yourself, you can do anything you want. But if you want me to pay for it, well, you know, here's what your options are.
I like that logic.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So you've got undergrad taken care of, but you mentioned that your daughter is wanting to go on to med school?
Right, possibly. I mean, she's starting to talk about that now, and I'm looking at the price tag, and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, is she going to graduate with $150,000 worth of debt? So, you know, one of the questions I had was, should we assume debt on her behalf, co-sign on loans for her, or should she just be on her own trying to get this financial aid?
Generally speaking, when you're a graduate student, you are considered an independent student, and therefore you're able to get the aid on your own. And that is the best way to do it. If at some point you decide you want to help, then pay off her loans. Don't take out the loans in your name.
Right.
Lisa, let me ask you this. I mean, you've already done so much in putting her through undergrad, and you're going to be doing the same with her sibling. Have you taken care of yourself?
Yeah, we do. I mean, we're doing all the right things. My husband kind of manages that side of things. I lay awake worrying about it at night, but he takes care of it all. You know, we have 401ks, an IRA account. He's got a pension.
Then why are you lying awake worrying about it?
I don't know.
You seem to be doing it much better than most people, right?
Well, and I also, you know, I lay awake sometimes worrying about my parents' situation.
Are you sandwich generation?
I'm a sandwich generation, yep. Both my parents are living nearby in independent living, and they have invested conservatively.
But do you feel like they're not quite comfortable enough that you may need to help down the line?
Well, the problem now is that when they first moved into independent living and we sold their home, things were fine, but since that time, my dad has required increasing assistance with activities of daily living.
And that can cost a lot of money.
It is draining the bank account. So is there anything we can do this far into the game so that they're not spending down all their assets? Then, you know, me and my siblings will have to foot the bill.
Medicaid is a health care program for the poor. And if you have assets, you don't get health care programs for the poor. But it is a comprehensive health care program. The reason why people worry is because of long-term care. If you need long-term care, skilled nursing care, not
right.
medical care.
Like Lisa's father.
Exactly. Then call the Medicaid program and ask them, how does this work? What would this mean to my mom if we spend down our assets? You know, some states also have partnerships where you can buy long-term care insurance, and you can check with your state to see if they have this long-term care partnership. And if it really worries you, then you might want to think about buying that insurance for your mom.
And Lisa, I think I would also say, just to bring it around to your first question, that if you're lying awake at night worrying about whether you're going to need to buttress your parents' retirement and end-of-life care, you really shouldn't be worrying your head also about putting your daughter through medical school.
Right. One worry at a time.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
All right. Well, thanks so much for the call.
Thank you very much.
And next we go to Rebecca, and she is in the Emerald City, Seattle, Washington. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, Tess.
How do you catch the show there in Seattle?
I listen to KUOW, which is at the University of Washington in Seattle.
Wonderful.
Fabulous public radio station.
They are fabulous. In fact, they helped us out a few months ago. We actually did the show from Seattle, which was awfully fun.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, got to spend a week in that gorgeous, gorgeous city. By the way, some of the best restaurants I have ever been to.
It is. And a day like today, when it's a beautiful summer day, it's the most beautiful city.
Yeah. Summer in the Pacific Northwest,
yeah.
I have to say, is you can't beat it.
Yeah.
So what do you do there?
Well, I've been in broadcasting my entire life.
Oh, just like us.
Just like you. And I've been teaching college part-time.
You teaching journalism?
Yes. And also, I've been writing the news at a television station here, which its parent company is in bankruptcy. And so part of this story is that after 4 or 5 years there, I just turned 60, I lost two-thirds of my income in June when I was laid off by the television station.
Well, you know, Kathy, we hear a lot about newspapers having trouble, but not so much about TV stations. But I guess all of journalism is on the rail at this point.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, so let's get back to your situation. And you said that you lost one of your jobs a couple of months ago. Is this a concern about retirement money?
Yes, it is. But it's also, you know, my story is that I was widowed twice when I was young.
Oh, wow.
By the time I was 33.
Twice?
Twice. And so it changed absolutely everything in my life.
Well, obviously, yeah, it affects your life drastically. Financially, tough for you?
Well, I'd been a reporter before I was widowed, so at least I had a good career to fall back on in those days. But one thing I found I needed to do something for me and make a change, and I always wanted to go to graduate school, so I moved from Oregon to Rhode Island to go to Brown, and it was a fabulous experience, but I did take out a student loan.
Oh, so when was this?
That would have been 1984, and you can probably see where this is heading.
You still have those student loans?
That's why I was calling you. I, off and on, have made payments, tried to restart the payment process, but it's been years since I've been able to make a payment. I keep getting, they're very good about tracking me down. They've never, sued or attached my wages or anything, but I know it's on my credit report.
All right, Rebecca, how much money are we talking about?
Well, it has grown to $67,604.89.
And do you know what it was when you left school?
I believe it was under $10,000.
Oh, my gosh.
This has hung over my head, as you can imagine, for many years. And my life is really good now. I'm very responsible now, but I just had a complete block. I didn't really care about what was going to happen because it seemed like the worst had already happened to me.
Yeah, well, I can see how you would think that. But, boy, Kathy, 25 years later.
And you know what? I mean, the problem with being in default is that fees and interest just keep on accumulating. And so this debt that was nothing 10 years ago is now going to, be the debt that ate Manhattan. What you need to do, Rebecca, is get your loan out of default.
How do I do that?
Well, there's strategies for it. I actually pulled up a website. It's studentloanborrowerassistance.org.
We'll have a link to that on our website.
Okay.
Yeah. And they can tell you about how to rehabilitate your student loan. Because once you rehabilitate your student loan, the great news is there is a program that is just for you.
Really?
Yep. It's called income-based repayment. And what it does is it takes a look at how much you earn and sets your payments based on what you can afford. And it also starts a clock running that says you can only be owing student debt if you're in this program for 25 years. And after that, it's forgiven.
So the clock starts again.
Yes.
Well, my parents lived in their late 90s.
Well, you know what? I mean, yeah, it's not great. It would be better if you'd maybe address this a little bit earlier in life. But since you didn't, start now.
Okay.
Let me ask this. And I am certainly not one to advocate that you shouldn't pay your debts. But given that she's, what are you, like, you're 60 or so?
I just turned 60.
60? Given that she's 60 years old, why bother at this point if it hasn't affected her life for the last 25 years, except that she feels guilty about it?
Well, because it might. I mean, you can garnish wages, and student loans generally cannot be discharged in bankruptcy. So no matter, what you do, this debt is going to follow you around unless you address it. Problems like this, they just don't go away.
Well, I would really be open to that, and we'll pursue that.
It's a great place to start.
All right, so Rebecca, you've got some marching orders here.
Thank you so much, Tess and Kathy.
And you know what? I'd really love to find out from you down the line what you were able to do, what you found out. So give us a call and let us know how it turns out.
I will, and thank you so much for your expertise, Kathy.
Well, thanks very much. It's nice to talk to you. Good luck.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Bye.
Oh, Kathy, I know we're going to, I know I at least am going to get some haranguing emails about saying that he should just not bother with the debt. But I don't know. I just kind of feel like, I mean, at 60 years old, at 70, really, you want to go back to paying off your student loans?
You know, I can't tell you how many people who I've talked to who are almost in exactly that situation.
Yeah.
Student loans were this stealth risk that
right.
people never really figured because they thought, oh, we grew up thinking that student loans are the good debt. You know,
right.
it's an investment in your future and they're low rate and they're all this other stuff. More people have gotten into trouble with student loans than you would ever believe.
Yeah.
If you go into default, the fees and interest that accumulates is just horrendous.
All right, then, for the record, pay all of your debts. Okay?
Good job, Tess.
Thank okay. you. All right, well, do send us your money questions. Our phone number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, and we spell that M-O-N-Y, creative spelling. Or send us an email through the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Kathy Kristoff, great as always to have you on the show. Thanks so much.
Thanks very much, Tess.
And remember to always check with your own financial professional before making any big money decisions. Just a few weeks left to fit in a summer vacation. Sigh. And if you waited till the last minute, you are not likely to find lots of great travel deals. Unless you're a certain kind of traveler. The kind who's willing to spend your hard-earned time off traveling to spots other tourists are abandoning. Marketplace's Rico Galliano tells us about the rewards and risks of crisis tourism.
A few weeks back, I spoke with Alexia Shaw. She's a photo archivist living in London, and usually she takes her summer vacation in Spain.
I go there about every year, but it's the prices are going up there. It's actually not much cheaper than London now.
So this year, she had a different idea.
Well, I was thinking of going to Greece this summer.
Sounds reasonable enough, beautiful country. Except earlier this summer, the news out of Greece sounded like this. Angry street riots over the government's proposed austerity measures. And just this week, Greece's main business association said one in seven stores has closed as a result of the downturn. Doesn't seem like the ideal setting for a relaxing vacation. But Alexia wasn't deterred by the unrest.
I think it's mainly only in Athens, and it occurred to me that perhaps it might be a little cheaper now with the bankruptcy fears.
It's opportunistic, but she's right. Four-star hotels in Greece are up to 25% cheaper this summer, and that's to be expected. Christopher Elliott's the consumer advocate at National Geographic Traveler. He says when a destination gets bad publicity, travel prices drop, the poster child being Mexico. Last year, that country was hit with the twin problems of a swine flu outbreak and drug violence on the border.
That scared a lot of tourists away. So last spring, we saw some excellent deals. I would say prices were probably 30 to 40% lower because they were just trying to get people to come back.
And Elliot says the dangers had been blown out of proportion. Travelers who did their homework found most Mexican vacation spots were far away from trouble.
People read very carefully and they said, you know, this is not going to affect me. I'm not going to one of the major cities. I'm going to Cancun. I'll go. And they saved money.
But who do you trust when you're doing your homework? Your destination's Ministry of Tourism? Greece's ministry insists vacations won't be disrupted. It's so sure, it announced a guarantee. If you're stranded by a strike, the government will pay for your hotel. But tourism accounts for 15% of Greece's GDP. They need to lure visitors. Experts suggest travelers try a less biased source of information.
The U.S. Department of State.
Michelle Bernier-Toth is a director at the department's Bureau of Consular Affairs. She says their website lists constantly updated travel alerts and warnings.
A travel alert describes a security risk which we deem short-term. Upcoming elections with the potential for civil unrest or violence, a hurricane. Travel warning, on the other hand, describes chronic risks or threat to U.S. citizens abroad.
i.e. countries that could be unsafe for a long time. All alerts or warnings are not created equal. Some urge travelers to exercise caution. Others suggest avoiding a country entirely, even if it's not politically correct to say so.
countries do let us know of their concerns about the impact of a travel alert on things like tourism, we simply issue them anyway.
Crisis travelers are assuming a certain amount of risk. And if you're thinking of mitigating that risk with travel insurance, you might want to think again. Genevieve Shaw Brown is a senior editor at Travelocity. She says most policies won't reimburse your travel costs in the event of war or civil unrest.
But what they really don't cover is fear, right? And that's really what can make someone cancel a trip, fear of something happening in an area that they're going to.
Which is why she suggests travelers treat this kind of trip like a risky investment. In Los Angeles, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace Money.
There is something in all of us, I'm pretty sure, that at some point just wants to chuck it all and go fulfill an alternate destiny, a life we're sure would be better, or at least more interesting. Last week, we brought you part one of a series in conjunction with CBC Radio in Canada. It's called Money Changes Everything. Today, part two. Probably not a story for our younger listeners, by the way. About a guy named Sean McNeely, told by CBC producer Kathleen Goldhar.
I first met Sean about 10 years ago when we both worked for the same newspaper. But we became much better friends a few years ago when my son and I started driving him to work.
Hello.
Good morning.
Oh, sorry to make you wait.
And Sean is always complaining about this day job.
You feel like you're screaming and saying, people, people.
Sean's a writer, and a really good one. Years ago, he worked as a travel writer, jetting off to these glamorous places. But he got laid off after 9/11 and ended up working as a communications manager for a group that helps to turn new technologies into businesses. He works in a cubicle, doing really more pencil pushing than writing. And yet it's such a high-stress environment that it had a physical effect on him at one point 2 years ago.
I started having real trouble breathing. I started to sweat profusely. I started to kind of shake a little bit. And I remember thinking to myself, is this a heart attack?
It was a panic attack. His doctor made him take 5 weeks off. And he and I talk about him quitting altogether, all the time, going freelance, being his own boss. But it's just too scary in this economy. And then, not long after his stress leave, a woman propositioned him in a business kind of way.
So when she first approached me, honestly, I jumped at it. The idea of being able to write about and talk about sex was great. I couldn't wait to do it.
Sean started writing erotic fiction, steamy online stories and novels for women that would cost anywhere from $1 to $7 a piece. Here's a sample.
Lisa felt so alive. Paolo brought her drinks and rubbed her shoulders and her arms, touching her often, whispering in her ear, and drawing her hair off her face.
It gets a lot more musky from here. The she Sean mentioned earlier is his friend and now writing partner, Marie Fraser. She has a PhD in neuroscience.
So I could easily lobotomize anybody in the room and you could walk away, but no, that's not my calling in life, so.
Instead, her calling seems to be dreaming up carnal fantasies for women everywhere. At first, Marie just did it for the money. But then she realized she had a talent for it. And it was fun. A lot of fun.
Then, through meeting Sean and realizing, aha, he's a pretty good writer himself, and asked him to edit something for me for which I paid him. It was a true business deal, and it came out so good.
The writing or the sex?
The writing. No, the writing. Hi, Mom. The writing. Yeah.
To be clear, Sean and Marie are just friends. Marie's mother knows that she writes about sex, but she doesn't know how graphic the stories are. Sean's in the same boat.
I'm a little concerned because my family keeps asking to see some examples and I don't quite know what to do.
Because there's no doubt about it. These stories with titles like The Invisible Touch and The Sheriff and the Widow, they're all about the sex.
People don't buy erotica for plot lines. They don't buy erotica for character development.
What have you learned makes good erotica?
I'm still learning. One of the things is the buildup, whether it be tension, whether it be lust, something has to build before things actually happen. Which
it's
is
like
funny.
Real life.
Yeah, which is funny because as a male, I'm like, huh, what do you mean? But apparently this is the case.
Amazing.
But what's really amazing is how much money these guys are making. Since the release of their first novel 2 years ago, Sean and Marie have been receiving regular royalty checks. At the beginning, they were getting over $2,000 a month. Now it's about $1,100. And that's just for one story. They have a book of short stories sold but not out yet. Two under consideration. And Marie handed Sean 4 to edit the day that I visited.
Women are buying this stuff because you could be up at 1 o'clock in the morning, you can't sleep, find a website, boom, there's a story.
It's a platonic relationship, but you're sharing your fantasies with Sean.
Well, you know, it can get a little awkward, but we can override that.
Yeah, at the same time, ultimately, we want to make the best story. And so, believe it or not, that trumps everything. And we'll kind of argue and bicker and debate. No, no, it shouldn't have sex in this room. It should be in this room. And no, no, it shouldn't be this position. It should be that position. And we almost look at it clinically. And it makes me laugh because there are times where I think, oh my God, I can't believe what we're discussing like this.
I think it's a good way to picture your living.
And you see it as a transition away, like you're saying.
Yes, because I'm constantly saying to Sean, he's going first. We're transitioning him first and then me. I fully expect to be doing this as a full-time career within the next probably 2 to 3 years.
Whereas Sean is planning on quitting his day job this fall. And it's a wonder he stuck it out this long. During his stress leave last year, a therapist told him he should quit immediately. But he thought he'd just be trading one stress for another, fretting about how will I pay the bills? How will I pay the mortgage? And he's definitely having those thoughts now.
Oh, yeah, I am worried to death, actually. There's no such thing as a benefits package for erotica writers. It doesn't exist, as far as I know. There is a chance that I'm going to have to change my lifestyle to a great degree. There's a chance I might not be able to live in such a nice place, or I might have to move from owning something to renting something. And there is that element to it, and I've made my peace with it, and I'm willing to do that.
Because in the end, he says, he'll once again be able to look at people in the eye and say he's a writer. Lots of people can say that and mean it. But somehow it's different when you're getting paid. And somehow, even though it's not exactly high art, the check Sean gets from writing about Lisa and Paolo mean more to him than the ones he gets from his day job.
Like, I remember thinking, I can cash this. This is real money. It's not fake. It's not like Monopoly. I can actually pay. This is money.
She started to tell him about her practice, but he interrupted. No, Carita, tell me more about Spain. Tell me what you loved about it.
In Toronto, I'm Kathleen Goldhar from Marketplace Money.
Stories about clients and billing turn to tales of sunsets, wine, and art.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. The BP oil well in the Gulf of Mexico is finally capped, but it'll be years before anyone knows exactly how widespread the effects are on the area's economy and environment. What might be easier to judge is its effect on our habits. It takes less than a day for this country to go through the 205 million gallons of oil that poured into the Gulf over 3 months. So did all those videos of oil-slicked animals and beaches and horror stories from Gulf residents prompt us all to action? Here with some answers from our sustainability desk is Chrissy Clark. Welcome, Chrissy.
Thanks, Tess.
So a spill of this magnitude surely must have affected our oil consumption?
Unfortunately, it doesn't look like many people have changed their habits in any way when it comes to this stuff. Consider this MSNBC poll that came out recently. 65% of the people asked if they had changed their habits due to the oil spill said no.
Well, of course, we did not become oil addicts overnight. Right. And I mean, I remember even a couple of years ago when gas prices hit, you know, almost $4 a gallon and everybody said, oh, this is when we'll get off oil. Yeah.
Right. And that actually even changed our habits more than this oil spill did.
Yeah.
But here's a brief history just to sort of put this in perspective. What you might call the petrochemical age, when petroleum products really became the material and energy basis for our lives. That didn't kick into gear until around World War II, when it was a matter of national security. We had this urgent need for raw materials, and so government worked with private industry to come up with alternatives, and they turned to oil and the hydrocarbon molecule, which was very flexible. And then, of course, once the war was over, there was a huge expansion of the interstate highway system in the 1950s, and that dramatically changed the way our cities and towns were laid out. So all of this created a world where we used oil in lots of different ways, and we used a lot of it.
And we still do. I mean, we have cars,
We have airplanes, power plants. We use oil to heat our homes, even run our air conditioners. This is a lot of very hard stuff to give up.
Yeah, and in fact, about 85% of the oil Americans use is for all of that stuff that you just mentioned. The other 15% goes into the chemical industry to make industrial products and more than 6,000 consumer products that we use.
Yes, I hear a quote coming to mind. One word for you. Plastics.
Exactly.
Benjamin.
But it's not actually just the obvious things like plastic bags and bottled water. I started to do a thought experiment as I was doing research for all of this. And I thought, okay, what's the first petroleum product I encounter when I wake up in the morning? Hmm. And you actually don't even have to wake up. You're lying on it because the mattress is full of stuffing that has various synthetic materials.
Wow.
Then you have the alarm clock, of course. That's probably plastic. Then there's some finish on the wood of your bed, most likely, that is made from a petroleum product. When you get into the bathroom, your medicine cabinet is full of cosmetics and medicines, which are all based on oil. So it's everywhere.
Okay, I give up then. I mean, what am I supposed to do?
And that's the thing. I know this is really annoying to say, but on an individual level, there really is not a lot that you can do.
Wow. What happened to sustainability?
I know. And it's hard because I know that on the one hand, there are a lot of individuals out there who are well-intentioned and who are trying to do their part. But I spoke with a guy named Harvey Mollich, who's an environmental sociologist at New York University, and he said as many well-intentioned people as there are out in the world who might want to cut back on their oil consumption, mass behavioral change is a very hard thing to do. And he actually found hope in cigarettes.
Cigarettes?
The idea is that, like oil, smoking is something that is very hard to quit on your own. But in the last several years, smokers have actually started voting for smoking bans and cigarette taxes in the hopes that since they can't quit by themselves, maybe they can at least make it harder for themselves to smoke. Hmm. So this environmental sociologist, Harvey Mollich, says that we should take a similar approach to oil. If people want to be less dependent on oil, they need to vote for policies that make using oil harder and not using oil easier. Things like taxes that will discourage people over time from using cars, or encourage people to make life decisions about where they live, or things that on a higher government scale are changing national policies, like the way we design highways or plan cities.
Has he gotten himself off oil?
I asked him that, and here's what he said.
No, I've not done a thing. I do the right thing only because it's easy. And I think that's the solution, is to make it much easier for people to do the right thing.
There you have it. Thanks so much, Chrissy.
You're welcome.
Last week, we met Beverly Davis. Her three-bedroom house in Fairburn, Georgia, went into foreclosure earlier this year. She's trying to raise money to buy back her home at auction, and she's doing it by selling cornbread. As of our last conversation, she had $80,000 to raise, so we've called her up again. And Beverly, how was the week in cornbread sales?
Amazing. I got almost $3,000 in sales, and they're still coming in.
So how much more time do you have then before the house goes on the auction block?
Every Wednesday, the real estate agent and I, we check a certain site that the bank has that lists the home. And it was not listed today.
Hmm.
So I keep saying 21 days. But you know what? For all I know, they could put it on there next week. My prayer is that they don't put it up until I have raised every single dime.
Well, so you told us last time that you were needing another $80,000. You've knocked $3,000 off that, so now it's down to 77?
Yes. Now, the $3,000, I must say this now, I have a very hefty profit margin. So the whole $3,000, even though it's in sales, you know, a portion of it goes to paying the expenses to get the product created and shipped out. And then I leave the profit, and that's what I'm putting to the side to go towards the house. Now, I will tell you this, and I'm very encouraged by it. It's just the opportunity to do another product to get some more sales going.
Oh.
And I'm doing some T-shirts.
What are the T-shirts going for?
I was going to do $15, but I'm starting to think that's a bit expensive. 10.
10?
Yeah.
All right. Best of luck.
Thank you and have a great day.
And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, want to teach your kids about money? The ideal classroom might be right there in the backyard.
We want somebody who's friendly.
And
person that pays the rent on time.
Meet some treehouse landlords. And in the meantime, be sure to visit us on Facebook. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Susie Lechtenberg. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tessa Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, working to solve America's retirement savings challenge through innovation, service, and performance. Putnam, a world of investing.
American Public Media.